This coming Saturday, the fans of literature for children and young adults will celebrate the legacy of Dr. Ernie Bond. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. This week on the campus of Salisbury University, the 16th annual Children's and Young Adult Literature Festival will take place, but missing will be Dr. Ernie Bond, professor at the Soudell School of Education at the university, who specialized in the children's young adult literature. Bond died suddenly last September, leaving a void among the advocates of the children's literature and literacy. He began organizing the festival in 2008, introducing best-selling authors and illustrators from around the world. This morning, we want to take a look at his legacy as well as this year's annual festival. In our studio is Dr. Patricia Dean. She is a professor at Salisbury University and who teaches at a number of courses on language and literacy. She's also organizer of this year's festival. Our authors are Jen Culverton Johnson, whose book Seeds of Change is illustrated by Sonia Lynn Sadler. Also, Shelley Rodner, author and photographer, with the book Grow, Raise, Catch, and How We Get Our Food. And also, finally, Adrian Fogelin. She is a novelist and author of Crossing Jordan, which apparently is being made into music, I understand. Also has a thing called the Front Porch Library. By the way, it's 6 years, I guess, you guys have been. How long you celebrate?
Has it been? It's been much longer than that. 2002 is when I first came to Salisbury.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
I helped Ernie the very first time with Nikki Grimes and Charles R. Smith Jr. were some of the first guests he had. And then I came aboard and he grabbed me quickly, knowing we had an equal love for children's literature.
Hmm.
So I always think, even though I don't look like Vanna White, I used to think I was sort of his Vanna White. I kept him straight. I kept him organized. And then as our relationship grew, we became much more of a team to organize this event. But he was always the one that was out in front. And I preferred to sort of do the background work and make sure things were happening. So I've had emotions about him this year, both sad and mad at the guy. I needed him here. I had a million questions. Like, I'll ask Ernie. Well, I can't ask you, Ernie. But I felt him large in my life this year.
Well, what
on
do you
my
think,
shoulder.
What do you think his legacy was?
Well, I think one thing that Ernie did was bring joy to everybody, I would say. You know, I think in our department, we miss his raucous laugh most of all. And if you were having a sad day of any kind, Ernie would be there with his arm around you and said, hey, it's okay. We're going to be okay. And I think I would say his legacy was not only his knowledge for children's literature, but also his positive nature and his joyous attitude about life.
And said all of you know it. Jen, what about you? What's your sense about his legacy and who he was?
Well, one of the things that Patty touched on is Ernie brought joy into the room wherever he went. But the biggest thing that I remember Ernie for is that he built a bridge between writers and illustrators. My illustrator is Sonia Lynn Sadler, and when our book Seeds of Change was published, we didn't know each other. But the award, the Greenberg Earth Award, brought us down to Salisbury together, and we were able to meet each other. And this developed into, I would say, one of the biggest and most important creative friendships that I've ever had with another person, Sonia Lynn Sadler. So I'm always grateful to Ernie and, of course, to Patty for giving us that opportunity to come together. And because of that, I'm very sad to say my illustrator, Sonia Lynn Sadler, died when she was 52 years old of lung cancer. But Ernie and Patty were, you know, the most open and receiving people to allow this award to happen, which is called the Sonia Lynn Sadler Award. And it's an award for young, up-and-coming, diverse illustrators. So it couldn't have been a better place or time to do it at Salisbury University. But, of course, it's a sad moment because Ernie was, you know, the center of it. And now Dr. Dean is the center, and she's doing a phenomenal job, I'd say.
Thank you. Adrian, what about you? What taught you about his legacy?
I don't actually know Ernie, but I met him.
But obviously, yeah.
I came in 2008 to receive an honor award, and I went back to my journal, and this is the note I wrote about him in my journal. We were driven to the hotel by Dr. Ernie Banks.
thought.
That's a lot. I keep doing that. A children's lit professor with a twinkly smile and the appearance of a benevolent fairy tale bear.
Mm. Beautiful.
Sorry, Ernie. I am so sorry about screwing up your name.
I'm sure she'll forgive you. And Adrian?
And Shelley.
Shelley.
Yep. Everybody Shelley sort of, you know, I'm in agreement with what everybody said. I was lucky enough to win an award for a book, and I wasn't sure what I was stepping into, and it was a world beyond just receiving an award. And I think back of Ernie as this gentle giant who fixed everything wrong with the audio mm-hmm. system, had time for a beer, had time to take us out to see the wild ponies, and knew every author, every book, and mm-hmm. had such dimension to conversation. And he brought me into his family, too, the few times that I met him. So in some very short visits, it felt like I got to know somebody deeply.
Shelley, by the way, we just mentioned a moment ago, but the Sonia Lynn Sadler Diverse Illustrator Award. Tell me a little bit about that, who won it, and what goes into choosing who wins the award. And this is the first time, I think, right?
This is the inaugural award.
It's the first time for it. And
Jen's the one that initiated the award and spoke with Ernie and I about starting this. So why don't you talk a little more
about that? I'll talk a little about it, and then you can pick it up. So what we wanted to do is Sonia had created phenomenal art, and we wanted to keep her name and her art alive and give opportunity to young people who would be able to follow in her footsteps. This book, Seeds of Change, won the Coretta Scott King Award for New Illustrators. So we had thought, I had thought, that Salisbury would be one of the greatest places to start this award. I asked Ernie, and Ernie began the process, and then Patty really took over, and just together we've had a wonderful time mm-hmm. creating it.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say? And this year's winner, do you want to talk about this year's winner?
Yes. Yeah, so this year's winner, we were just, one of our criteria that Ernie and Jen and I thought would be somebody that had written less than 5 books. Mm-hmm. We wanted to give somebody an upstart that's a diverse illustrator to try to broaden the children's literature world to mm-hmm. include more books of children of color so that they see themselves in these books. And so I'm the president of a special interest group called Literacy and Social Responsibility with the International Literacy Association. And that in July this year, it was in Boston. And our keynote, our guest speaker for our special interest group was this gentleman named Eric Shabazz Larkin. And he wrote a book about, we should have brought that book, but it's about farmer Will Allen. And it's all about food, sustainable food from ground to the table. Yeah. Used to be Lee and Lowe Publishers. Lee has separated from Lee and Lowe, and he's now started his own organization, and it's all about healthy, sustainable food. Right. And so Eric, he actually goes by Shabazz, was a speaker, and he was dynamic. He is an artist by trade, but new in the children's literature world. And so when we searched lots of places for new and diverse illustrators, mm-hmm. and he just kept coming back to my mind. So he's the lucky one this year that's our inaugural winner.
Yeah.
He's driving in today, and he will be here through Sunday.
Yeah. Well, speaking of food, Jen, I want to turn to you. Seeds of Change, which is actually about a real person. Tell me a little bit about what caught your attention? How did you catch on to this particular person? And tell us a little bit about the inspiration here.
So Seeds of Change is the biography of Wangari Maathai. She planted 30 million trees with the Greenbelt Movement, and in doing so, taught young girls and women to become financially independent. I was drawn to Wangari Maathai for many reasons, but most of all, I admire her, and I just find her a remarkable person because she was able to take two very difficult issues, young girls' rights and the environment, and come together with a solution of planting trees. And she faced quite a bit of challenges for doing that. She was put in jail. She had to leave her country of Kenya. But finally she came back, and her country, as well as the world, acknowledged her wonderful contribution of planting trees.
And so her, although she has passed away of ovarian cancer, her legacy is outstanding throughout the world. For example, the Girl Scouts adopted her and her program and are now planting trees in her name.
Tell me, by the way, this particular tree that she focused on, it seemed rather unique, something that her own people, her own ethnic group, seemed to revere.
The Mugamo tree, is that what you're referring to? This is a very interesting tree because in the book itself, and I'm sure young children everywhere, you learn nature by touching things. And so the Mugamo tree is home to many, not just for the sweet figs that it has, but to the geckos and the monkeys and the birds that come to it. But the Kiku, who are the national ancestors of Wangari Maathai, believe that when a person dies, their spirit lives in the tree. So when Wangari was alive, she always spoke about her grandmother and how her grandmother taught her the ways of nature and how she promised not to cut down the Mugamo tree. But sadly, when Wangari left to go to the United States to be educated, she came back and she found that not only the Mugamo tree was cut down, but many of Kenya's forests were cut down for timber and coffee plantations.
I want to turn to you, Shelley. Amongst other things, you're certainly into food here with Grows, Raise, Catch, and how we get our food. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved, particularly in terms of doing food.
Well, I am a foodie. What struck me after spending a lot of time in kindergarten classes, so many five-year-olds, especially urban kids, had no idea where food came from, besides the refrigerator. So I combine my love of good food and farmers and fishermen, and I combine the two to really make the link for kids to explain where food came from, and then putting in the environmental piece about needing a healthy earth in order to do so. Just to raise a consciousness.
Now, also, one of the things that's unique about your books, I mean, obviously they're for children, but they're photographs. Most when we think about most children books, we think about drawings and all kinds of. But you chose the medium of photography.
Right. I am a photo illustrator, technically. And I've had really good response. I find that kids like the real thing, you know, given all the media that they're exposed to, real people, and. And it also allowed me to put in the dimension of diversity so that there's people of all colors, there's all ages. So I try to be very inclusive in that other dimension as well.
I guess you've been a UNICEF photographer. What was the most interesting place you think you photographed?
Oh, that's really tough. It's usually the place where I'm at the moment because it's just so present. And
very sweet.
But I think Bali. Yeah. Thailand and Bali were two of my favorite places. And like my children's books, and I had no idea that would become my career, I was photographing children, education, and women. So it crossed over once I became interested in education, got degrees in early childhood education, wound up in a kindergarten classroom, and then I combined the two, education and photography, and it was a perfect blend for me.
And how the children responded then to the books? I mean, are they
really
interested in the?
They are, and one of the most common responses in the Q&A, which is my favorite part, is they want to know how they could get to be in my next book. So,
I can just imagine.
And there is a child from Salisbury that you took a picture when you were here before that's in one of your books.
Yes, and they haven't seen the book yet.
Yes, but they're the body actions.
Yeah. I'm always, my eyes are open, always looking for kids. And they're not models. They're just beautiful kids, you know.
Beautiful kids?
Yeah.
Adrian, so you're a novelist. Tell me a little bit about your novel. Crossing Jordan, I guess, is being made into a musical. But tell us a little bit about the characters, because this is sort of a racial kind of situation.
The models for the characters are my neighbors.
Okay.
I am a very, very local author. I live in Tallahassee, and I live in a low-income neighborhood with a lot of diversity. And the story began with a 9-year-old girl knocking at my door and saying, "Guess what, Miss Adrian? We're going to have to move soon because you're getting to be too many black people in this neighborhood." But I have to tell you, that is not typical of my neighborhood. But it did cause me to write a book, and it did result in her family leaving. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the book, it begins with the building of a fence between the yard where the white family lives and the yard where the black family is moving in. And in fact, in the musical production, it begins with a song that goes to the hammering sound of the man building the fence. We produced it first in 2011, and we're producing it again at the Chapman Auditorium in Apalachicola. It's a WPA theater, big, old, wonderful theater that swallows up the sound of everybody's voice like you wouldn't believe. But one of those great old theaters with the fold-down wooden chairs. And we do this great thing in the last number, which is a song called One Day, which is about things being different. And it begins with the voice of the black grandmother singing on the stage. And then the cast comes in, and they all are singing. And we've seated people in the audience, and they begin to sing. And the words are in the program, and the melody is very simple. And what happened last time is, by the end of the performance, the entire audience was singing this song about one day things will be better, things will be different. One day we'll see the clear blue sky.
Was it difficult to write about this?
Yes.
Particularly for children?
Yes.
Or young adults?
I also, at certain points, thought, I'm writing about something that's over. Prejudice really doesn't exist anymore. And every single time I thought that, I would hear another story. Like I heard from, I was at a school, and the teacher told me about being a child, and she was in a farm family. The black workers would come and help at harvest time, and her parents would feed them. And she thought, this is really great, because one day a man and his son actually ate at their table. And she thought, oh, everything's fine. And then her mother threw away the plate, the fork, the knife, the spoon, everything that had been used to serve that meal. And she realized nothing had changed. And the thing is, I will talk sometimes to groups about this. And often the white members of the audience say, it's over. And you see every single African-American person shake their head. My neighbor across the street said, it never going to change. It's never going to be any different. But I keep hoping, and I keep writing toward that.
So, and the kids, how do they respond?
They really like it, because the heroes of the book are the two 12-year-old girls who become friends. And who, they're both runners. They love to run. And they start out competing right. with each other. But they end up running in a race where Jemmy, who is the black girl, gets clipped on the shoulder by another runner and falls. And Cass turns around and helps her to cross the finish line. And they make the newspaper for having done this. And Jemmy says, boy, I can't believe this. It's like, I can't believe sometimes that we didn't win the race, you know. And the grandmother says, you sure did cross that finish line first. You crossed the Bodine Lewis finish line. Yeah. You brought these families together, so of course you won.
So what do you make of, sort of a broader question, but what do you make of the atmosphere that we live in now? Are you less optimistic? What sense do you get? I mean,
I feel concerned.
Yeah.
Because I think that the emotions that are being brought out right now, which are hateful, I never realized how close to the surface they were. And so what I've done is I've doubled down on my community. And I put tremendous time into my neighbors. And they put time into me. We're a community. And I think strength at the bottom of the food chain, which is where we are, will get us through it. But I'm deeply troubled right now.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jenny? You wrote about this African woman who comes from Kenya. What sense do you get about where we are when it comes to issues of race? And you're writing about somebody who, I mean, for a lot of kids, particularly in the United States, Kenya is just very, very far away. I mean,
I think it's a very difficult situation that we're in right now. But like Adrian, I want to write on the side of peace, and I want to continue working with my own community for that. In terms of Wangari Maathai and the image of an African woman, there's a lot of stereotypes that happen with that. Most people assume that an African woman is someone that's poor, that someone that lives in a hut. But Wangari Maathai happened to be one of the first women in East Africa to receive a PhD. I think what would be important step moving forward in terms of changing that image is if media would show the reality. And the reality is there are amazing African women that are scientists moving forward in the right direction, and they're not in these, small ruined villages. Today, in fact, is the March for Science, and I know for a fact that Wangari Maathai's movement is working very hard to show that young women have a place in science now and going forward. And when I say young women, I mean all young women, not one type of young women, but all races of young women have a place going forward with science.
And obviously, particularly with this new award, I mean, you're really emphasizing diversity as well as just people starting out.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Ernie Bond so well taught me about windows and mirrors, it's important that children see themselves in books. And I think what we find is there's a lot of white authors and illustrators that get published, less of illustrators and authors of color. And I think publishers like to have somebody that they know is tried and true. And it's hard for new people to get started in the business if they don't already have a legacy before they write a book. So we hope to bring some light to some people that are getting started and hope to give them some credibility and give them a little boost. Because our whole group is all about diversity. Yeah. People of color, people of all kinds, all walks of life, and that we want, like your song, one day, we want to all just be equal together.
By the way, now, obviously, in this particular show, all the women, they're all women except me. what do you see a changing role in women in participating in this writing children's books, or is it their particular genre? What sense do you get about that?
You would probably be the best person to answer this because you see more books.
Yes, and actually, I see more disparity, not so much in women versus men as I do of people of color. Mm-hmm. I think it's better now that we're bringing it to people's attention. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more, people are aware of it and looking for it more. I'm actually working on a research project with two of my college students who are interns who are researching children's libraries in 6 different classrooms, and they're looking for a variety of family books to see whether we are offering our children books to see themselves with, single parent families, parents that are incarcerated, gay and lesbian parents. We just want to make sure our children are comfortable with who they are and that they can see themselves in books. It's the biggest, it's the biggest validation of who you are.
So remind me again, remind our audience, what's going to be happening then tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow is our Children's Literature Festival. It starts at 8:30, it goes to 3:30. This is a special year as we commemorate the legacy of Dr. Bond. So we have 10 authors and illustrators with us, which is a really big deal. Usually we have 4, and we're so proud this year to celebrate his life. Almost everybody there, except for 3 people exactly, have known Ernie in the past, and I invited them specifically to celebrate his life. You can still register for this. It's www.salisbury.edu/childlitfestival, all one word, and you can come tomorrow morning at 8:30. It's in the CRC Curriculum Resource Center, 226 in the Teacher Education Building, which is now Conway Hall. So please do come. We'd love to have everybody there.
We were speaking with Dr. Patricia Dean. She's a professor at Salisbury University. She also teaches a number of courses on language and literacy and organizer, of course, of this year's festival. Authors have been Jen Culverton Johnson, whose book, Seeds of Change, was illustrated by Sonia Lynn Sadler. Also, Shelley Rotner, author and photographer with, amongst other things, a book called Grow, Raise, Catch, and How We Get Our Food. And, of course, finally, Adrian Fogelin, a novelist and author of Crossing Jordan, And we appreciate you all taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Stephanie Fowler.
And this is Tony Russo.
And this week on So What's Your Story, we're going to be talking with Emily Rich, who is the new editor of the Delmarva Review.
Join us Saturdays, 1 p.m., following This American Life on WSDL, Rhythm N News. Stephanie never says Rhythm N News.
Still not doing it.
In these turbulent times, next Monday will mark Holocaust Remembrance Day, or Shoah. And it is perhaps a time to take stock of a crime against humanity committed by one of the most sophisticated nations of the world at the time. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. When the Nazis took power in 1933, few could imagine what lay ahead for a nation of Goethe and Schiller. But 12 years later, millions had died at the hands of the Nazis, including 6 million Jews. It is an event unique unto itself, and yet not so isolated from the social and political environment from which it sprang. With us to talk about this is Diana Wagner. She's a Salisbury University professor and is director of the Maryland Holocaust Educators Network. Also, Martin Paraboom. He is dean of the Fulton School of Liberal Arts, who teaches about the Holocaust at Salisbury University. And also, Arnold Beanstock. He is a rabbi at Beth Israel. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good morning. So I want to sort of go around the room, taking a temperature about what you think the current atmosphere is. We've seen, I know, some increasing number of incidents, anti-Semitic incidents, particularly in Europe. There's been certainly reporting here in the United States. Rabbi, I'll begin with you. What sense do you get? Are we just noticing it more, or do you think there's something else going on here?
I think we are noticing it a little bit more, but I think there's something also that's going on. I must say the issue, of course, cemetery desecration has really been an issue for a very, very long time. So maybe it's positive in a way that desecration and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries has come up. And, of course, sometimes the media does help, you know, create stories or add to stories or bring the public forward. Cemetery desecration, you know, has always, though, been an issue. Of course, you know, with the emergence of the group, the alt-right group, as it's called in the United States, that when you get intense nationalistic feelings, and then, of course, when you look around the world with Marine Le Pen in France, also serious concerns about that in the Jewish community in France. Also, of course, kind of the nationalistic movements that are beginning to emerge in several European countries, there are concerns. And have these things always been there? Probably, yes. But there, you know, are socioeconomic conditions and sort of the zeitgeist. It's interesting, before we started airing, you raised the similar issues about, Hitler could have only succeeded because he built on things that were pre-existent to him. So I think that's very important to issue. Things don't really emerge de novo. They always have, unfortunately, a long past to them that go back in history.
Martin, what about you? How do you take the temperature?
I would say along similar lines, anti-Semitism has really existed as long as there have been Jews and Christians and peoples of other faiths. As long as there's been an identifiable other that is Jewish in whatever society you're talking about. So I think even 5 or 10 years ago, organizations like the Anti-Defamation League have kept very careful records of incidents of cemetery desecration and so forth. So I would think we would probably see a bit of an uptick today, given the greater license, seemingly, that that seems to have been granted by the election of Donald Trump and other figures in let's say in Western politics. We see the same in Poland and Hungary. We have rather right wing, nativist, somewhat chauvinist movements that are sort of tapping into anti-immigration sentiment. And somehow a sense that the best nation is one that is somehow, in some fantasy, pure.
Diana, what about you? What sense do you get?
Yeah, my work with Southern Poverty Law Center has made me very aware of the increased reporting, particularly since the election, of acts of intolerance, hate crimes, incidents like cemetery desecrations. Would those have made national news necessarily in a different time, or would they have been regional? I'm not real sure. I think it's a combination of both better reporting, more thorough reporting, but also an uptick. Because I think when there is nationalism, it creates an us versus them sort of mentality. And so folks who feel under attack from some vague outsider will feel safer to express those views. And so I think the nationalism can sort of amplify divisions among people. But certainly folks, I'm thinking about Dylann Roof, the Charleston shooter at Mother Emanuel Church. He held those ideas for a very, very long time. But something in the last couple of years created a climate where he felt it was finally time, it was okay to act on those feelings. And so I think climate shifts, and that folks who harbor real fear and misunderstanding can sometimes find that there's now a stage for them to act on their beliefs or distortions or fears.
Why don't I turn to you? This idea that in the mid-1800s, there was a rise of nationalism. Countries began either to solidify, particularly with the Germans, or you saw this push to, say, dismember, as it were, Austro-Hungary, which obviously took place after the First World War. What change do you think between the anti-Semitism that existed prior to that sense of nationalism and how it changed after that?
That's a good question. I would say that the more historic forms of anti-Semitism express themselves in more religious terms, that, you know, the old tropes about Jews using the blood of Christian children in their rituals and that sort of thing, going back to the idea that the Jews killed Christ. So that it tended to express itself. I don't want to say it's religiously motivated necessarily, but that it was a hatred that found expression or excuse through religious means. In the 19th century, you see that similar form of hatred carried on, but now in a more secular environment, where even science is deployed in the interest of hatred. Where now you're trying through eugenics and so forth to justify this eternal animosity in scientific, even rational terms, which is just bizarre, of course, but is nonetheless a testament to how powerful that hatred can be.
Because one of the things that struck me is that Jews, particularly the diaspora, really, they were trying to find ways to fit in. I mean, and so they, for instance, they were excluded from, say, owning property, for an example. So you get certainly an emphasis on finance, obviously, of the Rothschilds who come up later on. That they're squeezed into these little social and economic spaces, business as opposed to being, say, participating in a guild, for example, is another example. And that they're trying to find throughout their history in Europe as a diaspora ways to figure out how to fit into this very cloistered kind of existence, it seems to me, in Europe.
Yes, and in the 19th century, of course, the irony is that that's all very much loosened up, or that the concept of citizenship, at least in a place like France, where it's a legal definition, is the idea that this would not be religiously based at all, and that Jews could be citizens of France and could participate in national life just as anyone else could. And so in some ways, we have a reaction to that. And of course, it's varied throughout Europe. In Germany, the sense of national identity emerges a little bit later than it does in France and is more tied up with romantic notions of the blood coursing through your veins and so forth. So it's less grounded in reason than we would find in France, although, of course, you can also find plenty of chauvinism in France as well. You cited the right. Dreyfus affair earlier. So it's very complicated, but I think the remarkable thing is that this hatred endures through the modernization of states in Europe. It's a real irony.
So, Diane, I want to turn it to you. So what is it, do you think, that the Nazis are tapping into so successfully? In many ways, it seems as if, and we'll talk a little bit about this later on, that this fixation with anti-Semitism, with the Jews, mm-hmm. particularly for the Nazis, runs all the way to the end of the Second World War, even while they're mm-hmm. losing their draining mm-hmm. resources, you know?
Absolutely. I mean,
what is that?
It's widely believed and understood among Holocaust scholars that had it not been for Hitler's obsession with the Jews, he probably could have won the war. But huge resources were drained for the propaganda machine, for example. I mean, they're a whole side story is that they created a whole Titanic movie and pulled one of their ships out of circulation for that. But, you know, Hitler's obsession, you know, you have to remember, though, that, you know, Germany was coming out of World War One, where all and all of a sudden Germany surrenders when they weren't really losing. It was a time when the economy was terrible. People were suffering. And so, you know, Hitler said, I'm going to create infrastructure. I'm going to create jobs. I'm going to put you back to work. And, you know, we're going to make Germany great again. That's essentially what he was running around saying. And I think his obsession, you know, he was obsessed with racial purity. He was obsessed with anti-Semitism. He was obsessed with returning Germany to its prior greatness. I think that the anti-Semitism is something that people could get behind. I mean, around that time in the late 30s, there was a Roper poll of Americans, and 60% of Americans at the time said that Jews had, quote, objectionable qualities. Anti-Semitism wasn't anything new. And just as I think we see now in the real sort of troubling nationalism, we want to blame someone, right? So there's if we're having trouble economically or nationally or socially, it's easier to point the finger to somebody else. And so I think that there's that sort of basic instinct combined with historic anti-Semitism combined with the state that Germany found itself. If it was 1933 and I was listening to Hitler talk about everything that was wrong and everything he'd like to do, he might sound pretty darn convincing at the time. So, and his plans unrolled over a period of 12 years. You know, it's not like he came to power and wham, we had final solution. I mean, things unrolled really quite gradually and slowly, and then they started to unravel for him at the end. And so it was a slow rise of strategy on his part.
Well, that brings me to something that, you know, we talked a lot about why the Germans wound up doing the things that they did. I was curious also about the Jewish community and why it did the things that it did, that it didn't suddenly get out. I mean, obviously, this was moving at a much slower pace, as you indicate. Although, I guess I was finished reading the book In the Garden of the Beast, in which you can tell from the description by the first U.S. ambassador to Germany, the fear was already spreading within the first year. I mean, it was by the time he had gotten there.
I think it's really important to stress that Hitler was, there was no cover up or any sort of covert quality to Hitler's policies vis-a-vis the Jews. They ran on that. They very very shortly upon taking power enacted a whole bunch of laws and even short of the federal government, the national government, as it were, doing what it did, government at every level immediately began persecution of the Jews. And the response was such that by 1938, two-thirds of Germany's Jewish population had emigrated. And think of that, because we think, and when I teach the Holocaust, people say, well, of course, isn't that what you would do? But on the other hand, you have to consider that people had lived in Germany for generations. They considered themselves to be German. How is it that you would readily agree to give up everything that you've got, because the system was entirely skewed to make sure that you would leave with as little as possible? So it was a terrible choice to have to leave, and yet it was, in retrospect, clearly the best choice to make. But it was a terrible decision people had to make, whether to leave with their whole families or to send their children, as was the case after the annexation of Austria in 1938 and the Kinder transport. There's sort of a temptation to think of that as a happy story of Britain, you know, warmly embracing these children. But there's a terrible, terrible tragedy at the center of that. I wouldn't say that Nazi Germany was in any way, shape, or form at any time covert about its intentions vis-a-vis the Jews, nor Hitler himself, who in Mein Kampf talked even about using gas.
I have a piece on this, so you'll get to hear it if you come to the service, where, you know, the question is always, why didn't the German Jews do more? They felt that it would blow over. They just felt that it was a brief aberration, just like we have politicians here in the United States that we dislike and say, oh, 2 years, 4 years, they'll be out of office. So the German Jews, they identified so much with German culture. Weimar culture in the 1920s basically had a strong component of Jewish involvement. the Jews in Germany felt as much at home there as American Jews do in this country. They were the lawyers, they were the doctors, they were the playwrights. And also, again, they're intertwining. Of course, Hitler despised, most of all, the Mischling, as he called them, the mixed bloods. And so a lot of, just like in the United States, of course, rabbis bemoan our high rate of interfaith marriage out, but that's also occurred in Germany as well. So there were so many families that were intertwined with basically the typical German Lutheran family, where their partners, one person was Jewish, another one was Lutheran, another one was Catholic. And so they felt that this was, that Hitler was just an aberration. And in fact, there are still German Jews today who, that's their approach towards the Holocaust, that Hitler was aberration. For them, Germany is Goethe, you know, music, very, very difficult. And so that's why, and then of course the personal choices that people had to make about leaving an elderly parent or having children. And I guess we can ask this, you know, when individuals find themselves in any very, very difficult political circumstance, you know, the question that comes into someone's head is, well, why don't they leave? And each person can give a reason why they feel that they have to stay. And it's interesting that German Jews, of course, when they're looked at upon by other Jews, there's, in fact, a word that's used for them. And when some of them have, where they live in Israel, they're kind of stereotyped, oddly enough, as classic Germans. You know, they're very punctual. This is a stereotype of German Jews. Like we have of Germany, the German Jews, everything has to be the second. Everything has to be orderly. Everything has to be, you know, very rational and systematic. And so German Jews totally identified. And, of course, they assimilated very, very rapidly to German culture. It was Moses Mendelssohn, who's in history kind of known as the first kind of modern Jew, who translated the Bible for Jews into German. And so and we should realize this, that every single confrontation with the modern secular world which Jews have experienced was born in Germany. So all the modern Jewish religious movements started in Germany. Jews becoming attracted to communism was born in Germany. Jews using Jews identification with politically liberal movements started in Germany. So Germany is the mother of all creativity in Jewish life. And of course, the great giants of Jewish thought created the Lehrhaus, the school of Jewish learning. So we really should realize that with the horrific side of the Holocaust, also Germany also was really the mother of all Jewish creativity in the modern world. And also the study of academia, Jewish academia, the study of Wissenschaftliches Judentum, the scientific study of Judaism, which is, of course, that's why we have Jewish studies at the university, was also a gift of Germany.
Let me ask you, so at this point, we have a series of laws that get imposed, you know, the Nuremberg laws. We have Kristallnacht, which was the attack, the Night of the Broken Glass, and so on. When, from your perspective, Martin, when do we begin to see this idea that this isn't just simply we're going to have deportation, which was initially a lot of discussion, particularly amongst Nazis in the initial administration? They talked about deportation, but that just gets left by the wayside, and you have this idea of, no, we're just going to simply eliminate them. What's the progression there, do you think?
That's, again, a sort of very complicated question, because I think the intentionality is really there, and if you were to sort of study this from the perspective of Hitler, you know, Mein Kampf is pretty clear about his intentions vis-a-vis the Jews, and I think the National Socialists and their behavior from, well, certainly prior to gaining power, but certainly immediately upon gaining power, that those intentions are there's nothing good about that, right? Whether or not it's murderous, of course, is something that's not maybe immediately clear, and that's part of what informs decisions to stay versus go. But I think there are a couple of schools of thought, really, and sort of big ways of thinking about this whole experience that on the one hand sort of says it was in Hitler's mind from day one, and that he just was able to sort of set in motion a series of events that resulted in the extermination of a substantial portion of European Jewry, versus more of a functionalist approach that certainly the intent was there, but that it took a whole lot more than the intent of one very powerful and very crazy man to make this happen. And so that there is a lot more about this that is not predetermined when it comes to the actual mechanics of destroying millions of people. And in 1938, even, the plan isn't in place yet. The intent is there, but the plan specifically is not in place. That is much more of a function of how the war unfolds. You have the invasion of Poland in 1939, which, again, if you think about it from a rational perspective, which doesn't do us a whole lot of good necessarily, if Hitler hates the Jews so much, why is he, of course, this all has to do with greater, I was going to say the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, but the Greater Germany, of course, the Thousand-Year Reich, they were going to expand at the expense of these no-good Slavic peoples. But, of course, in invading and overrunning Poland, they gained control of millions of Jews now, as opposed to the 600,000-plus that lived in Germany in 1933. And so they had to decide, again, from their point of view, what to do. And the initial approach was to, well, let's round them up. Let's get them out of the countryside. Let's concentrate them in the cities so that you have people forced into ghettos, which, again, has a little bit of a historical resonance if you think about Venice and the places where Jews in medieval Europe had been forced to live. It was very, very different when you're talking about Poland in 1939 and 1940. But that kind of illustrates the sort of improvised nature of this. They feel that they have to do something, and yet exactly what they're going to do is yet to be determined and planned out. And so the machinery that also ultimately becomes the final solution is worked out over the course of those first 2 years of the war. And beginning in 1942, you have a system in place now where with accomplices across occupied Europe, but even corporations like the Deutsche Bahn, you have to get the trains to coordinate the shipments of people in cattle cars to these killing centers in Poland. This is something that, again, the intent you can see, you can trace back to the beginnings of National Socialism, but the actual plan and the execution of that plan is something that's very much a function of the war and the nature of the war, specifically in Eastern Europe.
That leads me, Diana, to one of the observations, and it's not particularly original, is that you didn't have to have just the Himmlers and the Hitlers carrying this out, but ordinary people, whether it's getting the trains, whether it's delivering the deportation letters, I mean, there's a certain, like, people just sort of went along with participating in their little piece of this process without thinking.
Yeah, well, yes, and the ordinary man thesis has been out there for quite a while,
right, exactly.
And it was normal, everyday people. You know, one of the ways that we try to separate ourselves from the likes of Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, and those guys is that we label them crazy. Oh, they're crazy. They're crazy. But in fact, at the Nuremberg trials, lots of people were jailed for a long time, and the jailhouse doors were thrown open, and psychologists and psychiatrists examined the folks at the Nuremberg trials, and only Stryker, the Reich's publisher, Julius Stryker, was the only person found to have antisocial psychopathic tendencies. The Nazis didn't want crazy people because crazy people don't follow the protocol. Crazy people follow their own fantasies. And so people were vetted very carefully so that you would have obedient people following the rules. And so, one of the big lessons of Holocaust studies that we try to emphasize to people is that the perpetrator is you and me. And there's a tipping point. There's a tipping point that we will get to. For some of us, we might think it's really high, not for $1 million, not for $5 million, but there's a tipping point at which we too can engage in extraordinary evil. And so I think the keeping in mind that the perpetrator is not some imaginary monster psycho person. The population had to, really what about 10, 15% of the population probably actively worked along throughout Europe, 10% of the population resisted, and everyone else just kind of went about their business. And I think that's analogous to whenever we see movements here politically. There's a political resistance. It's probably 10 or 15% of the population right now against new policies. And so I think it's important that we understand that this is not an anomaly. And we look around at Syria, we look at Congo, we look all over the place. There's crazy things happening are not necessarily perpetrated by crazy people, if that makes any kind of sense.
Well, why don't I turn to the concentration camps themselves. What is going on, do you think, psychologically, for both those Jews who are inside the concentration camp and for those who are perpetrating them, who may not necessarily be the camp commandant, but nonetheless, what does that do psychologically to those two groups of people? You think anybody? Rabbi?
The individuals who are in the concentration camps want to maintain a sense of dignity and respect and normality as much as possible. You know, we look at the ideal model camp, of course, you know, a Theresian, where people have art and music and culture. We have writings among traditional religious Jews where they try to observe, well, it's Passover still, where they try to really keep a commitment to the cycle of Jewish life. And it's amazing that more and more is being discovered. Oh, I saw this phenomenal program about the, well, maybe it was on a public television, about the violins. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you see that? Wasn't it incredible? People trying to maintain their artistic gifts. So individuals, even under intense pressure, I guess this goes back to Diana's discussion about sanity, that people, even under the worst of circumstances, mm-hmm. if they have basically good mental health, try to maintain a sense of order, especially for their children or grandchildren. We know, of course, that individuals often write that what kept them going was their concern for their loved ones. And Viktor Frankl's magnum opus, Man's Search for Meaning, it's his father and the love of his father that propels him and allows him even to survive. And he claims that individuals, if they have a meaning, even on the most horrific circumstances, that meaning can give them sort of the strength to continue. And oddly enough, the individuals who lost that sense of basic purpose or meaning, those are the individuals who suffered the greatest in terms of psychological damage and also physical damage. As far as the perpetrators are concerned, it's, again, there are normal people doing abnormal things. These individuals are their loving husbands, their loving fathers, it's hard for us to conceive of individuals doing horrific things, but we know that throughout history, individuals who do horrific things to some people, on the other hand, can be very, very loving to people mm-hmm. who they care about. So I think that raises the issue to us as well. So I would say this, when we look at, you know, the camps that the Jews went to, trying to create a life for themselves as much as possible and trying to have as much personal dignity as much as possible. And that's what we see. And even, of course, this friend of Anne Frank's who stepped forward recently, she's a mm-hmm. beautiful, beautiful piece. She said, I try to remember Anne Frank, you know, and that's what we tell people when we do grief counseling, to try to remember the person at their best and what they were like as a whole person, and not to focus, of course, on their final demise and the difficulties.
Let me just go final, as we go into the final minutes. Start with you, Martin. First, do you think we've learned something from this? We seem to have, on the one hand, we certainly rush in. Mm. Certainly Bosnia, I guess, is one of those classic examples where they finally eventually went in. On the other hand, there are atrocities that occur that we may or may not be able to do something about. What do you think we've learned here?
I don't know. You know, I'm a historian and I guess a Calvinist, so take maybe sometimes a darker view of human nature and human fallenness, as we called it growing up. I think we have to work awfully hard as human beings to embrace and understand our humanity and to treat one another with the respect and kindness that are really essential to our survival. It's surprising to me that given how important it is, regardless of one's faith, to follow the golden rule, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that really transcends any particular religious faith and yet seems to work awfully well when it comes to fostering systems and cultures and societies that function well. And I guess what's so sad about our world today is that there's so many parts of the world where those societies just don't work. It's broken down. It seems to be so difficult for human beings to achieve that level of humanity and caring for one another where societies can function and people want to stay there as opposed to becoming refugees in other parts of the world. So that's my grim outlook.
what would you done? I mean, actually, I'm struck by, as I was listening to Martin here, struck by the fact that the recent missile strikes into Syria were sparked in part by this emotional reaction to the kids. I mean, what about that? I mean,
yeah, I'm thinking about that. I mean, I think never again is really rhetoric, but it's not a verb, shall we say. You know, and I'm struck with, you know, if we're going to engage in a revenge bombing in Syria because children were gassed, but we won't help those children before they're gassed, there's a fundamental moral contradiction there. I really think it is either we care or we don't. I think that there's, and I think about the kinder transport, I think about the children turned away on the steamship St. Louis under the Roosevelt administration in sight of the Miami Beach. And they were not only chased away, they were shot at by the U.S. Coast Guard. And I think, you know, really, is our nationalism, is our fear of the outsider that grave? And so, no, I don't think the lesson has been learned. And I fear we have a lot of instructional opportunity in the coming years ahead of us.
Rabbi, I'll give you the last word. Do you think we've learned something?
I guess quote. Yeah. I'm going to join the group. as what we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. And I don't know who said that, but it's very, very sad. It's very, very tragic. But, of course, we know since the time of the Holocaust, there have been incredible genocides. One thing, though, that I find I will end on a positive note is that, interestingly, Rwanda and Israel have formed very, very close ties over this issue of genocide and doing mutual education. And in fact, there was this, I shouldn't remember her name, but this incredible American Jewish philanthropist, and she established a youth village in Rwanda on the basis of the youth villages in Israel that were created after the Holocaust to take in refugee children. And all the children in this Rwandan youth village were orphaned, of course, in the genocide in Rwanda. And they are from, you know, the warring tribes in Rwanda. And they've been given a new lease on life. So, as Diana said, it takes a lot of effort to be, I guess, the issue of altruism also, which is involved mm-hmm. in Holocaust studies. How do we create the altruistic personality? I guess that's the $64,000 question. But because this philanthropist was able to create this school in Rwanda, which functions and all the graduates have achieved a tremendous success. So I think that's what we have to look for, how to teach altruism. And I guess we have two academics here. Mm-hmm. So that's the issue of how can we do moral education, that university education should not only be academic, but there has to be a moral component of it as well.
Well, we're speaking with Diana Wagner, a Salisbury University professor and as director of the Maryland Holocaust Educators Network, also Martin Paraboom, in the Fulton School of Liberal Arts, who also teaches about the Holocaust here on Salisbury University, and also Rabbi Arnold Beanstalk. He is the rabbi of Beth Israel, and I appreciate all of you taking time to stop by and talk about this.
Thanks, Don.
Well, thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.
Hope you can join us this Friday and every Friday at 8 for Vintage Country with Tom Pittman. We're going to be featuring the top 10 for the year 1952 at the start of the second hour and just great country music throughout.